Good thing I had my helmet on. I'm Dave Cohen, jumping in the game just for a few minutes here for Tommy on WWL as we talk about the developments over the weekend as it relates to what's going on in the conflict between Israel, Iran, and the U.S. involvement in that. Joining us to help us kind of find out where we're at with this now is Eric Laub, an associate professor of politics and international relations at FIU and a non-resident scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace Middle East Program. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Glad you could be here. What were there any developments over the weekend in terms of the ceasefire that had been holding last week or anything that we learned new about the U.S. involvement in the effort to end or at least delay Iran's nuclear program?
Well, the ceasefire seems to be holding for the time being, and we have leaders on all sides, Israel, the U.S., and Iran, claiming victory and issuing bold statements. Since that time, there's been a national intelligence estimate by the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency here in the U.S., as well as by the IAEA, the UN nuclear watchdog, saying that rather than having obliterated Iran's nuclear program, the United States set it back by several months. And so this contradicts the narrative by President Trump and even the Israeli narrative. And Trump was asked over the weekend whether if he had to bomb Iran again, if he would do it. He said yes. But in the meantime, the ceasefire is holding and we'll have to see how these tenuous events develop moving forward.
How does that affect the conversation now that not only was this leaked report from the Pentagon critical of the bombing as being less than accomplishing the absolute mission of obliterating Iran's nuclear capabilities, but now we have this international report that seems to back that up and says that Iran could very quickly resume its work to try and develop a nuclear weapon?
Well, this is obviously very concerning for regional and even global non-proliferation. If Iran actually has voted at the parliamentary level to stop cooperating with the IAEA and potentially withdraw from the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, although that hasn't been approved at the higher levels. But nonetheless, we'll have to see if Iran is able and wants to resume these activities, if that would lead to further confrontation between Iran, the United States, and Israel, or whether, as President Trump has indicated, there would actually be diplomacy happening potentially this week, and that the sides are going to try to iron out some type of deal, even in the wake of these intense hostilities that took place over 12 days for the last couple of weeks.
There's no doubt that the narrative for the last several decades has been that Iran wants a nuclear weapon, that it has been working on some level for decades now to develop a nuclear weapon. And we've seen these iterations of involvement and alleged cooperation with investigators to determine where their nuclear program is at, then periods where they refuse to let anyone in. Where are we at in the evolution of Iran's seeking a nuclear weapon, and how do you see this unfolding moving forward?
Well, prior to the war that broke out on June 13th between the three sides, the estimates were that Iran was several months, if not a year or more, away from weaponizing its program. It had enriched about 900 pounds or so to different levels, closer to weaponization between 20 to 60%, but not the full 90% that's required for weaponization, along with other steps to do that. And so the question is, at this point in time, you know, given the threats that and the hostilities that Iran has faced, whether now it's incentivized even more to develop a nuclear weapon or whether it will use the program as a bargaining chip for sanctions relief and other types of diplomatic benefits that they could receive from the United States and international community.
How do we know who to believe at this point? Because we have U.S. and Israeli officials saying that the strikes that the pair of countries have have carried out, obliterated Iran's nuclear program. But now we have not only a leaked Pentagon report, but a UN report indicating quite the opposite, that they were only set back weeks or months in their efforts to develop a nuclear weapon. How do we know who to believe anymore?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that, you know, we're hearing one narrative of obliteration from politicians who have political incentives to show that this was an absolute or total victory on one side. And then we have these agencies, domestic and international, where experts and professionals are giving a different assessment. And so, you know, we may want to lean in that direction of listening to these agencies and experts and professionals who are trying to make more objective, sober assessments with less political incentives to do that. But again, we're going to have to wait and see, you know, if there's more evidence acquired over time to you know, lend credence to that assessment.
If Iran is trying to hide what capabilities it has, how do we get these intelligence reports, and how trustworthy are they? I mean, are there spies within the Iranian structure and government that are reporting information to our intelligence community? Are there other means, other by satellite or other surveillance, to determine where their nuclear program is at?
I mean, based on what I've heard, it seems to be more of the latter. Of course, Iran has been infiltrated, it seems, particularly by Israeli spies, in terms of something that had made its military and even nuclear program vulnerable, as we saw on full display during that 12-day war, with assassinations and hits to military nuclear infrastructure. But in terms of these assessments, it seems to be more using satellite technology and other technology to try to assess the damage. It seems that these assessments are based mainly on images to see if there were damage to these above ground and underground structures and surrounding areas.
But I guess it's really hard to tell if these bunkers are hundreds and hundreds of feet below ground, where they allegedly are doing this work to enrich uranium and try to get enough to create a critical mass so they can have a functioning nuclear weapon. Hard to tell from above the ground what's going on that deep within the earth, huh?
Oh, it certainly is. Although, again, analysts are saying that there's ways to see in terms of not just what these structures look like, but even the, you know, the mountains and surrounding areas, if to what extent they've been collapsed or to what extent they've been lowered. And also something else that particularly the IAEA is looking for is if there's any signs of leaks of radiation. And part of that has to come into cooperation with Iran's own nuclear agency, assuming they are being forthcoming and honest. And you know, apart from physical damage to the structures, there's also been reports that the Iranians knew what was coming ahead of time and were able to move highly rich uranium and even centrifuges out of the facilities before they were hit.
Well, let's hope that eventually we don't find out the hard way that Iran was successful in relocating equipment and is getting closer and closer to creating nuclear weaponry. Professor, anything else we should discuss before we let you run?
I think that's it. I mean, I would say the last thing is that, you know, President Trump, apart from discussing the, you know, trying to continue to hold the ceasefire and looking at developments involving Iran's nuclear program moving forward in terms of a way to tie in perhaps the cessation of hostilities between Iran and Israel with perhaps also reaching a ceasefire in Gaza. So we'll see if those two could be connected and what that looks like moving forward.
All right, Professor, I'm going to hand things back to Tommy Tucker now here on WWL. Thank you for your time. Tommy's got some questions for you.
You know what they say, for want of a nail, I forgot my glasses, and I couldn't see anything, and I realized at the last minute, Professor, I had to go get my glasses, so Dave Cohen jumped in. Let me take a break. I got some questions for you when we come back. 622 traffic now, WWL. All right, 628, Tommy Tucker, WWL. A rough start this morning. It's all my fault. I forgot my glasses, so I had to sprint back to the parking lot to get them out the car. But now I have them, and we're back, and the guest is back. Eric Laub, Associate Professor of Politics international relations at FIU and a non-resident scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace Middle East Program. Sorry, Professor, about the confusion, but it all goes back to one guy forgetting his glasses. Isn't that amazing? Let the butterfly effect, I guess. Let's talk real quick about, I'm confused because it seems as though for a while the president was criticized because we shouldn't have bombed Iran. Now they're saying he didn't bomb it enough, or they still have, I don't know, uranium that can be enriched. I don't see how it can be both ways. Do you? Am I missing something here?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it just shows the potentially, you know, based on the assessments that we're seeing, if the United States was unsuccessful in obliterating the program and they're still able to enrich uranium, whether the United States should pursue more military action or whether they should consider the diplomatic track, which President Trump has indicated, and perhaps think about, again, the framework of a deal where the demands by the United States international community are allowing Iran to enrich for civilian purposes and not allow them to weaponize their program, similar to a deal that we had back in 2015 before the U.S. withdrew from it in 2018.
So do we know how close they were to weapons-grade uranium, or we don't?
Well, according to estimates, again, and this is assuming that we have complete information and perfect information, which I think is a stretch, but assuming we're going by national intelligence estimates and even IAEA estimates, and again, some of these facilities were open to inspectors, the consensus is that they were months, if not a year or more away, with uranium, you know, 900 pounds of uranium or so that was between 20% to 60%, still a bit away from the 90% required for weaponization, and that they did have enough material, assuming they did raise that percentage to produce 9 to 10 bombs or so, or weapons, but that they were still a ways away from doing that, either, you know, months or a year or more.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time. Hope we talk to you again. Eric Lobb, Associate Professor of Politics, International Relations at FIU. Somebody texted in, extra glasses in the office is a real possibility. Yeah, I know that. The problem is you keep picking them up and bringing them to another place, and then you bring them to another place, and before you know it, you got 1,000 pair in one place and none at the other. Either way, we'll come back, talk to Dane Cialino about the SCOTUS rulings. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:42, 18 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. SCOTUS is done. The Supreme Court is done for the session, I think, maybe. I'm not even sure about that. Dane Cialino joins us now, professor of law at Loyola. How you doing, Dane?
Just fine, Tommy. Morning.
Morning. As I was saying that they're done for the session, I remember hearing something yesterday that they could hear some kind of emergency something or the other. Am I making that up or not?
Well, they could always hear emergency applications anytime between now and the formal opening of the next term, which is the first Monday in October. But yeah, they announced the last round of decisions from the 2024 term on Friday morning, actually. Yeah.
Let's talk about, I guess, the biggest one was the birthright citizenship. But was it about birthright citizenship or about the role of courts?
Yeah, it wasn't about birthright citizenship at all. That was the underlying case, but they only agreed to review the narrow issue, but important issue, of whether lower federal courts have the power to issue universal injunctions that are applicable all over the United States. Many found it odd that a single district judge in Monroe, Louisiana, could enjoin the enforcement of executive orders and federal statutes all over the country. And the court on Friday substantially cut back on the authority of federal district courts to do just that and held that universal injunctions, unless there's some particular circumstance that requires it to give relief to a party in a particular case, universal injunctions are no longer going to be allowed.
So let me take you back for a second and go through the procedure here. We're talking about, when we say district courts, we're talking about federal district courts, not state courts, right?
Correct.
So, and I saw on some of the Sunday morning shows yesterday, I think it was Lindsey Graham that said both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, are going to be griping about this in the future because they both went judge shopping. Explain what that means, if you will, and how it's happened in the past with district judges, I guess federal judges, to stop whatever it is you didn't like, and then, I guess, for the time being, issue an injunction. That's what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, I mean, forum shopping, judge shopping has been going on for a very long time, and we saw it actually in Louisiana. I think this is makes it particularly pertinent to Louisiana, because during the Biden administration, plaintiffs challenging Joe Biden's supported legislation and executive orders chose to bring lawsuits to challenge the constitutionality of the Biden administration's actions in the Western District of Louisiana, which is the federal district that includes Monroe, Shreveport, Lafayette, Alexandria, because there were some Trump-appointed judges who they those plaintiffs believed would give them a favorable ear to their arguments. So we saw a number of injunctions, nationwide injunctions, come out of Monroe. And at the time, the Democrats and supporters of the Biden administration were decrying the universal injunction, saying that they were inappropriate. Well, now the shoe's on the other foot, and judges, federal judges, leaning Democrat, have imposed universal injunctions on the Trump administration, and now Republicans are complaining about universal injunctions. So, yeah, I mean, this is one of these issues that's not really, it shouldn't be viewed as a partisan issue, but really as a question of what is the appropriate role of lower federal courts in the federal government. And what the Supreme Court said on Friday is that they certainly have a role to play, but it's not in issuing nationwide injunctions to stop federal laws and executive orders across the country.
Well, what does Marbury v. Madison have to do with this?
Yeah, that's the first case that every law student reads in constitutional law, and that essentially established that federal courts have the ability to review laws passed by Congress and signed into law by the executive branch for constitutionality. It gives essentially the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, the last word on what the law is and what the Constitution means.
So does this change that at all, or is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson kind of overreacting? She called it a zone of lawlessness in which the executive has a prerogative to take or leave the law as it wishes. Is that kind of like a dramatic statement? Because it seems as though...
Yeah, the Internet, of course, all weekend has been lighting up about the supposed smackdown that Amy Coney Barrett gave to Ketanji Brown in the majority opinion, essentially saying that it is a lot of hyperbole and that the majority's opinion really is all about curbing and preventing an imperial judiciary as opposed to an imperial executive branch.
But this doesn't, what happened on Friday has nothing to do with the Supreme Court having power over the executive branch, does it? Or is it just about...
No, not at all. Not at all.
That's what I think.
Yeah, not at all.
Is, right?
That's right. Although that issue wasn't squarely presented, I think everyone seems to agree that if the Supreme Court speaks on the constitutionality of a federal statute or executive order, that will be the last word, and that will apply across the country, whether it's by way of injunction or binding precedent that the other branches will follow, I think may remain to be seen. But I think everybody understands that as a matter of principle, the Supreme Court will make the final decision on all things constitutional, and everybody's going to have to respect that opinion.
All right, let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about a couple of different things, one of which is what happens to the birthright citizenship case now, because I don't know what the situation is. Are people born here in a country citizens or not? And I don't know what the president ordered, what effect an executive order has. Is an executive order binding until the Supreme Court rules on it? I don't know what happens from here. And we'll talk about some more stuff with Dane Celino when we return. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 652 8 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, our friend, about the Supreme Court ruling. So when it comes to birthright citizenship, the president's executive order said what? The district court did what? And now the Supreme Court ruling does what as far as all of that goes?
Yeah, shortly after taking office, President Trump signed an executive order essentially interpreting the 14th Amendment to not confer birthright citizenship on all people born in the United States. And that was almost immediately challenged in federal district court. At least two or three federal district judges issued nationwide injunctions prohibiting that executive order from having any effect. That's what the Supreme Court considered on Friday and ruled that those nationwide injunctions are not appropriate. So the court essentially remanded or sent back to the lower courts all of those cases. And pretty shortly after it did so, at least one of the plaintiffs amended his lawsuit to make it a class action lawsuit. And that's somewhat of a workaround of this new universal injunction principle that the court laid out on Friday. So that's what we're going to see now. I mean, we're not going to see the end of nationwide relief. It's just going to have to be done in a procedurally different manner through the cumbersome and more lengthy process of class certification. So that's what's going on right now. So I think the short answer is as we speak right now on Monday morning, those injunctions are still in place, at least as to the individual plaintiffs involved. But once these lawsuits are amended to make them class actions, I think we'll eventually see broader relief than that, which was discussed on Friday, namely that the relief would extend only to the individual named parties in the lawsuits. I think we're going to see some class relief. And eventually it's going to get to back to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they're going to rule on the actual merits of the issue of whether the 14th Amendment provides for birthright citizenship.
So what would that, first of all, if somebody is visiting from, I don't know, Canada, pick a country, Norway, and they have a baby here in the United States, as far as the law says now, that baby is a U.S. citizen?
He or she is, yes.
He or she is, okay. So with what the Supreme Court said and what the president's executive order says, does any of that change if people are visiting here or whatever and they have a child here? Is that child an American citizen, or is that to be determined later?
Well, that's what President Trump was seeking to change through his executive order issued in January.
But did he?
Well, that's what the issue was all about. The answer is yes, he did, as to those who are here illegally. But whether that's going to have any effect going forward still remains to be decided, because the court didn't address the merits of the constitutional argument.
So did his executive order say just for, and I don't mean to catch you off guard here, but his executive order just applied to children of those who were here illegally? So if they were here on vacation or with a visa or whatever, then it would not apply to them?
Yeah, good question. I know it applied to those, so-called illegal or undocumented aliens. Whether it applied to people who were here on tourist visas, I don't think it did. But again, I'm like you said, you caught me cold on that one.
Well, I didn't mean to. I was just curious about that because it's a big deal, and people don't know, I don't think, where they stand. Let's talk about executive orders in general, Dane, and how they apply to the Constitution and what's law, what's not. I know a lot of presidents, Democrat and Republican, have begun to use them because Congress has kind of abdicated a lot of their duties to the president, and President Trump saying, you know what, you don't want to do it? Fine, I'll do it. That's pretty much what's happening here?
Well, it's been happening for decades and decades. The presidents have taken more and more prerogative to try to get things done, so to speak, by way of executive order rather than by way of having Congress pass bills and present them to the press, to the executive for signing into law. So, yeah, I mean, what President Trump is doing is has started doing on the day of his inauguration is issue executive order after executive order to implement some of his campaign promises. Is that uncommon? No, but he's certainly done it at a rate and a pace that is unprecedented. But yeah, I mean, presidents have been doing executive orders for quite a long time, and some are far reaching and have enormous policy effects. Certainly not what the founders would have imagined back in at the time of the founding, but that's where executive power has gone.
So I guess I'm trying to understand the law. Is it always black and white, or is the law mostly gray?
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, there is a proper scope for executive authority under Article 2 of the Constitution, and that's the Supreme Court is often deciding these structural cases about where the executive can go and when it's gone too far. And President Trump is certainly pushing all the boundaries of those constitutional questions.
All right. So anything else about the Supreme Court rulings that got your attention, Dane, that came out?
Yeah, just the most important for Louisiana, the Louisiana redistricting case that involves whether the black majority district that put Cleo Fields back into Congress is constitutional, was punted until October. I think it's going to be re-argued again in early October, and we'll see what happens shortly thereafter.
Thank you. Appreciate your time as always, Dane. Have a nice 4th of July. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, our friend. We come back, we'll talk to Jeremy Alford, editor and publisher of La Politics Weekly. Louisiana moving to a closed primary system for some races next year. We'll go over those changes. Also talk about how Royce DuPlessis is viewed in Baton Rouge. And then we'll talk to Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member, about the travel ban being knocked down, latest on the Wisna Trust and more. A lot coming up. Stay with us. Tommy Tucker, Monday morning, or Tuesday, if you consider it's a short week. Back in a flash, WWL.